Our text this morning we found in Hebrews 12, but yet we're going to talk about David. But first, we're going to check our text in Hebrews 12, 5 through 11. It says, "You have forgotten the exhortation which is addressed to you as sons. My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor faint when you are reproved by him. For those whom the Lord loves, he disciplines, and he scourges every son whom he receives." Now we're going to go in a moment to 2 Samuel chapter 17, but as we open 2 Samuel, we need to remember, because we stopped this series a while ago when we were between pastors, this is actually David number 12. So we worked quite a bit on this, and poor David, we left him at the ford of the Jordan, not knowing what his fate was going to be. It scarcely seems a good way to treat him. So this week and next, we're going to pick him up again and take him along the journey of his life. But we see from the text in Hebrews that God will punish his children if they need it. But it says sons. Now, I want you to think back. Maybe you've said this yourself. Maybe you heard your parents say it about some child that was particularly unruly. It's not my job to civilize that child. That's not my child. Anyone ever heard that? Don't raise your hand. I have. Thankfully, I was not the child, because that would not have been good. But our children, whom we love, we discipline, and we discipline them so that they will grow up in such a way as to be a credit to themselves, a credit to God, a credit to others, someone you want to know. But somebody else's children, if they're bad, and we hear them screaming in the supermarket, we might just smile and pass it away, right? Say, that's not mine. Okay. So it's important to remember that David is being punished as we open this particular portion. And so if we go back further in 2 Samuel to chapter 12, and we'll remind you, but we won't read the portion, God speaks through the prophet Nathan, and he tells David, "I've delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave you your master's house. I gave you Israel and Judah. And if that wasn't enough, I would have given you more." Your text might say such and such other things, or it might say more things of a similar nature. But David took the gift of God, which was the authority of king, and he used it for evil purposes. And God says, "I can't tolerate that you did that. And I am going to punish you. I'm going to raise evil up in front of your own house. And the things you did in secret, I'm going to do openly under the sun for all Israel to see." Well, David is hoping to come back to Jerusalem. He's hoping to get through this rebellion without serious loss. And we're going to see this later, but there will be loss and there will be grief. And so in 2 Samuel chapter 17, David is there waiting for word to come again. Okay? And now Ahithophel was a very bright man, and he was advising the king. And he advised him, right now, do a bold stroke. Take an army, go. Just kill the king. Kill your father. Bring everybody else back. Forgive everybody. Amnesty for everybody. Because once he's gone, what difference does it make? Don't make grudges and hard feelings. Well, David's friend, Hushai, he said, "Well, now, it's a pretty tough guy you're talking about here, and if you don't make out, and I'm paraphrasing big time, if you don't make out when you go after him, then everybody is going to be faint-hearted because they know what kind of a warrior David is. We better get a big army. So, you know, this is, if you go back to the Civil War, this is the McClellan plan. You've got to be ultra-conservative and always sit and wait and make sure. Well, David then is warned of the plan. And what happens is him and his men cross over to Jordan and they melt away into the wilderness. They're gone. They're gone. And so now, as we go up to verse 15 in chapter 17, go quickly, verse 16, and tell David, do not spend the night at the fords of the wilderness. By all means, cross over, or else the king and all the people that are with him will be destroyed. And so they went out. They were gone. Now, we have to look at the strategy now. You've got David here in the wilderness. You got Absalom back in the wilderness. If we remember Absalom's record, he grew up pampered in the palace. He was no man of war. Okay? When his brother was killed, he had his servants do it, and he waited till his brother was pretty befuddled with wine before the servants even did it. So that's not something that you could call him a tough guy for getting done. He was not forged in the furnace of the wilderness with Saul chasing him and him running all the time and learning how to do it. But he liked the idea of leading an overwhelming force to defeat David. Oh, yeah. He pictures himself at the head of the force. But he was no fighter, and he was even less of a general. And no consideration was given to the fact that God gave the office of king to David. David had two separate chances to kill Saul, and he said, I will not stretch my hand against God's anointed. God gave him that office. He'll die of old age, or his time will come in battle, but I'm not going to presume to kill him. I won't do it. No consideration was given. So Ahithophel, who was a very smart man, could foresee what would happen if a man with David's military experience was given time to prepare. The element of surprise was the only thing they had going for him, and he was so sure of it that he went home, settled his affairs, and hanged himself. He didn't want to wait for the inevitable punishment. He could see what was going to happen. So the advice then from Hushai and the timely warning were the key to the whole battle. The subsequent delay in gathering the troops together. David was given time to prepare his forces. And Absalom, a man with no military experience, at least in the record, was left to gather inexperienced recruits and defeat a very experienced military commander with a group of tough and battle-hardened men that were loyal to him. He had no real chance to win. If you look up at 18:18, it says that, or 18:8, I'm sorry, it says that the battle was spread over the whole countryside and the forest devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. You know, these guys were so inexperienced they got lost in the woods. Well, David is in Mahanaim. This is located in Transjordan on the border of Gad and Manasseh, okay? And his men have persuaded him not to go into the battle. They want to keep him safe, okay? He was going to go, but in chapter 18 and verse 3, they say, the people said you should not go out, for if indeed we flee, they will not care about us. Even if half of us die, they will not care about us. You are worth 10,000 of us, therefore now it's better that you be ready to help us from the city. And so they persuaded the king. Now Absalom had to come out then of Jerusalem and come into this area for the battle. And David instructed his men to be deal gently with Absalom. Deal gently for my sake, with the young man Absalom. 18:5. All the people heard what the king charged the commanders. He hopes to do it without loss. He wants to keep his kingdom. He'd like to keep his son alive. It seems odd that he should say that when Absalom had every intention of killing David if he could lay hands on him. But apparently David had intended to forgive him for what he had done. But there's practical difficulties there, because if you look at Absalom, what are you going to do with him afterwards? If the rebellion ends, what are you going to do with him? You can't safely keep him, and you can't safely send him away to his maternal grandparents. He's still an eldest son of the king. He still has friends. And rebellion and conspiracy is still possible. And they're very bad for any country. They take a toll on the people. His rebellion, it cost the lives of a good many of his countrymen. So without the element of surprise, Absalom is soon defeated. And it says that he was riding on his mule and they went under an oak tree and he got stuck in the tree. And so he's there. The mule goes away, he's there, stuck in the tree, can't get out. And a certain man saw it and tells Joab. And he says, Joab said, well, why didn't you kill him? He says, oh, no, David says we should deal gently with him. Joab says, I'm not wasting my time with you. And he goes and sees to it that Absalom is killed. Joab has kind of a brutal practicality. We've seen it before. We'll see it yet again. And so his forces carry the day. David has the victory, but he does not rejoice. Instead, he is mourning. And so, after he gets the news, and we will go further in 18, if we go to 18:33, the king was deeply moved, went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he walked, he said, oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would I had died instead of you, oh, Absalom, my son. Okay? There was loss. He was being punished. He didn't manage to save both his son and the kingdom. And so we see here again the inability of David to deal with his children. This won't be the last time we see it. Even when they've done wrong, should our love for our children overcome everything else? Do we overlook every flaw or make excuses? The whole kingdom hangs in the balance. All he's worked for over the years, and he flees his capital again, and he faces death, just like when he ran from Saul. And with all of this prevented, and victory is in his hands, David then is fretting that his rebellious son has died in the battle. Well, he's rebuked by Joab, and when we go into chapter 19, it's reported to Joab, the king is weeping and mourns for Absalom, and the people are just sneaking back into the city. The victory was turned to mourning. So Joab says, time for a little plain talk. Then Joab came into the house to the king and said, today you have covered with shame the faces of all your servants who today have saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters and the lives of your wives and the lives of your concubines by loving those who hate you and hating those who love you. For you have shown today that princes and servants are nothing to you, for I know this day that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead, then you would be pleased. Now therefore, arise, go out and speak kindly to your servants, for I swear by the Lord, if you do not go out, Surely not a man will pass the night with you, and this will be worse for you than all the evil that has come upon you from your youth until now. The human condition is such that we really don't like ungrateful people. Ever worked for a place that was ungrateful? I have. And even though you accomplish a lot and even though you do a lot, however hard you work, they're not tired. Ungratefulness, or if you've done something for someone over and over again and they're not grateful. Ungratefulness is hard to take. So David's got to put sentiment aside and go out and speak to his troops, boost the morale, because they gave him the victory. Now, victory's not the whole answer, because David's problems haven't gone away. He's got to reassure his men, number one. So he went out and sat in the gate, got to reassure his men, and he has to do some political work to be welcomed back as king. He's got to decide whether to forgive or punish those who have acted against him. That's a big issue, because it's going to make the tone of the administration. After the Civil War, Lincoln said, with malice toward none, with charity towards all. That was the tone he wanted to set after the war was over. He told Grant to give Lee uneasy terms of surrender. Let the men keep their horses for spring plowing. So David has the promise from God that God is going to build him a house, going to build him a posterity, going to establish his throne forever. And so the steps he takes now are to do all those things. And so, 19:8, first he arises and sits in the gate. He, you know, works the crowd, works with the people, thank you very much for all you did, and so forth. And then in verse 11, he sends to the priest and says, how about speaking to the elders about bringing me back? Because, you know, Absalom's gone. Even today, we're waiting for the Messiah to come back and sit on what? The throne of David. And so David needs to get back to the throne. So after the rebellion is quenched, he wants to salvage the kingdom to hand down to his son and keep that line going. Okay, so Israel, rather than Judah, actually was the first to speak of bringing back the king. And even though Absalom was dead, it's not a total assurance they're going to bring David back. There's other sons up in the palace. Now, there's multiple wives, there's multiple sons. And the conspiracy started in Hebron, which is actually a city of Judah. And Judah was obviously involved in the conspiracy. David was anointed there, but he made his capital in Jerusalem. Could have been some resentment there. So he reaches out to Zadok and Abiathar. We see that in 19:11. And he wants him to speak to Israel. And he also tries to remind Judah of the tribal ties. The general for Absalom, Amasa, he offers him a job of commander in the army. You know, I'll bring him in. I'll get his loyalty, and I'll get the loyalty of the men that were with him. And so the rebellion is put down. David is on his way back, and he's got to set a tone. We remember Shimei, who cursed David and threw dust in the air and threw stones at him when he was going out of Jerusalem weeping and telling him what a bad person he was. He's one of the first to meet the king. Okay? And in verse 21, Abishai, that's a tough guy that's always at David's right hand, said, Should not Shimei be put to death for this because he cursed the Lord's anointed? But he said to Shimei, you shall not die. No, we're not going to do that today. This sets the tone. Okay? And David forgives him and does not shed blood. That's outside the walls of Jerusalem. And if we jump forward quite a few years outside the walls of Jerusalem, we remember another statement. Forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do. David's forgiveness is a signal to other guilty parties that the king wants to be generous. There's a brief chapter in here in the narrative of Ziba and Mephibosheth. And both of them are kind of pointing a finger at each other concerning supporting David. And they both kind of get half a loaf. From the biblical account, I never did quite figure out which one was lying, which one was telling the truth. That's a good question we should ask the pastor sometime. We also see David's gratitude to Barzillai, who helped him while he was in Mannheim, brought supplies and did other things for him. But Israel and Judah begin to quarrel. Okay? And this leads to yet another rebellion, which we see in chapter 20. A worthless fellow happened to be there whose name was Sheba, the son of Bishri, a Benjamite. Benjamite, that's the tribe of Saul, who still has reason to have a grudge against David. And he started a second rebellion. Okay? And so David is determined he's going to act quickly. We're not going to let this rebellion gain steam and get further along. We're going to put a stop to it. And so he sends out some troops. Amasa was supposed to call out the army, but he was taking too long for some reason. So David got his old friend Abishai. We remember him. He's the one when Saul was sleeping that said to David, oh, come on, I strike him with a spear, I'll just do it once. I won't do any more, and he'll be gone. I'll do it for you. David said no. No. So anyway, these were Joab's men. And it's very interesting to me, Joab was not the general. Text doesn't say, but I suspect he was being punished for killing Absalom. Probably demoted. So, anyway, as they're going out, they meet Amasa coming. Joab takes him aside. I got to chat with you. Well, what he does is he takes him aside, and while the man is unsuspecting, he strikes him and kills him. As I say, Joab is a very brutal man, and that's how he deals with rivals. Anyway, David brought him in, Amasa, to quench the rebellion and help secure the loyalty of his followers. Now he's dead. So Joab takes a very simple expedient. He's laying there, wallowing in his own blood, dying, and he tells the men, whoever is for David better follow Joab. And there's a very stark example right there in front of their eyes as to what might happen should they not desire to do so. So they follow him. The second rebellion is quenched by the death of the leader, okay? Because they came to a city, 2015, Abel Beth Maachah, and they cast up a siege ramp, and the people who were with Joab were wreaking destruction. They're tearing the wall down, the city wall. And I love this account because a woman comes, a wise woman comes and says, you know, if I could do the Jewish accent, I would, but I can't. But you could hear her saying, please, you know, come that I may speak to you. And he approached her and he says, listen to me. She said, formerly they used to say, ask advice at Abel, and thus ended the dispute. I am of those who are peaceable and faithful in Israel. You are seeking to destroy a city, even a mother in Israel. Why would you swallow up the inheritance of the Lord? You know, don't be wrecking this city. A lot of people in here. Anyway, it's the voice of reason. It's what we're lacking, even today. There's a lot of voices shouting, but where's the voice of reason? I don't know. But Joab is a very results-oriented man. He says, give me this leader of the revolt and I'll go away. But the woman doesn't even want him inside the city. So she says, hey, we'll throw his head to you over the wall and then you'll know that he isn't going to cause any further trouble. So Joab, results-oriented. He'd push hard, fight hard, even disobey orders to get to where he wanted to get. And you can see it in his behavior. But here he's offered an alternative. And he says, fine. And his behavior is really is a lesson to all of us. And I've cautioned people about this more than once. On the one hand, when you're striving for a result, ethics should still get in the way. What you should do right. But on the other hand, you should never get so caught up in a conflict that you throw away a chance to settle it. Maybe only for half a loaf, but throw away a chance to settle it, so caught up in the fight that you just keep on fighting. It's a very human tendency and very foolish. Well, killing of a rival to keep his place, a very evil shortcut. Joab should have and could have just shown his military leadership and skill to get his place. But he presumed to know better. But in 2 Samuel 20:23, we see that Joab, it says Joab was over the whole army of Israel. So he got his old job back. He got his old job back. And David does not punish him for the murder of the rival. But David doesn't forget either. He remembers the crime. There is kind of a dark chapter here, and I am going to just talk about it very briefly because time is getting away from me. But there was a famine in chapter 21 for 3 years, year after year, and David sought the advice of God, probably from one of the prophets, and the answer came back. The Gibeonites. The Gibeonites had been persecuted by Saul and some put to death, but there was an ancient pact between the Gibeonites and Israel. Although it was arrived at by deceit on the part of the Gibeonites, you give your word, you give your word. And David asked the Gibeonites, what can I do to settle this? I want you to bless us instead of curse us. I want you to be satisfied. And this is typical Eastern language in here. In verse 3 it says, what should I do and how can I make atonements? And in 4 they said, we have no concern of silver or gold with Saul or his house, nor is it for us to put any man to death in Israel. So they're hinting around. They said, we really don't want any silver or gold and really, really can't put anybody to death. And so there's an opening now for David to make an offer. Nobody loses face here because they haven't asked for anything and they can't be refused anything. They haven't asked. But David then says, I will do for you whatever you say. I will do for you whatever you say. This permits an indirect hint to be said directly because he promised to give them what they want. And if he refuses it, he'll lose face. You remember, when the king said, I'll give you whatever you want, up to half my kingdom. And the woman said, I want John the Baptist's head on a platter right now, right away. And the king was very regretful that he had said that, but he had made a promise. and because of the promise and because of his guest, that was the end of John the Baptist. But if we look in the scripture, in Deuteronomy 24:16, the Lord condemns the practice of putting sons to death for the sins of the fathers. Numbers 35:33 tells us, "You shall not pollute the land in which you are, for blood pollutes the land. No expiation can be made for the land for the blood that is shed on it, except by the blood of him who shed it." Now Saul and Jonathan had already been killed, and they were already dead. But we have the blood-feud culture of the time, which continues in the Middle East to this day. And so what they did was certain members of the house of Saul were given to the Gibeonites, and they hanged them. So the bodies then were not buried, but there was a woman of the house there that stayed there and kept them off. This was done by the old blood feud logic from the Middle East. Price is set in blood. The hanging is done at the first of the barley harvest. That would make it right at the Feast of First Fruits. And Rispa is making a lonely vigil there over the bodies until the rains in autumn. She didn't dare take them down, but she does what she can, and the example she sets of loyalty and sacrifice moves the heart of the king to amend the sentence and properly bury the bodies. Heavy rains usually come in October, and rain did come in the fall, which would then assure a harvest in the following year. And note that God did not relent and heal the land until the bones of the dead were properly buried. So with the healing of the land, we see David back on the throne with a secure kingdom. And he'll keep his kingdom, and he's going to die in his own bed. God has blessed him through trials and troubles, and he'll keep his promises. But what David learned, and what we should learn, among other things from the account, is we give thanks to God for the many things he's given us, which he has. But what God gives, he may also take away. And so David went from being king in a secure, luxurious palace to being out on the fords of the Jordan on the run again and in fear of his life for punishment, for abuse of his authority, for abuse of the things that God gave him. Because whatever God gives us, we're stewards of it. We brought nothing into this life, and it's a certainty we'll take nothing out. So even with our most precious possessions, our children, we're entrusted for them for a little while, and then we must leave and they'll remain. So next week we're going to talk about David one more time, and as I said, he died in his own bed, and we'll follow him to that point.